But the principled Cato could indulge in plots to kill people, bribe people, enlist them in violent acts, plunder the provinces. You know, when left leaders are uncompromisingly dedicated to their class struggle and use organized power against reactionary assaults, they're labeled dogmatic, rigid, totalitarian, power-hungry, even Stalinist, a nutty term that is often left conveniently undefined. When uncompromising conservatives like Cato rigidly adhere to their class interests, they're called principled. You know, some time ago, I was reminded of Cato. After a long day work, I like to relax sometimes by reading fiction. So I picked up a copy of the New York Times. And there was an article on Congressman Sonny Bono. Now, Congressman Sonny Bono had voted against almost every environmental law in the books. He voted for clear-cutting, for wiping out forests, you know. And the article was about the fact that Sonny Bono was skiing and he encountered a tree that stood its ground, you know. We here in Berkeley call that fight back. The tree really got the better of Sonny Bono. He died. This, I realized, oh my gosh, this is an obituary. And the obituary describes the late Congressman Bono as a stalwart conservative with a solidly conservative approach. The Washington Post describes him as loyal to his conservative principles. Now, is that positive framing or what? When do we hear of someone being called solidly radical or solidly Marxist or a highly principled communist? You know? Historians who say that we must immerse ourselves in the particular era under study and we must perceive it purely through the eyes of its participants, that sounds so great, but it's totally impossible, they forget that this usually means seeing the era through the eyes of its dominant class. In this instance, the Roman aristocracy. I mean, you know, 90% of the primary sources we have on the late Republic come from Cicero. Now, I mean, it's a skewed record. And how far do you apply that rule of what I call contextual immersion? Do you apply it to Nazi Germany? Well, anti-Semitism was a part of the Nazi political culture. That's the way they experience and perceive things. In any case, the rule of contextual immersion is regularly violated by most historians when it suits their own ideological proclivities. They don't see things through the eyes of the participants when casting their own disdainful eye on the common people, as I think I've been trying to demonstrate through this whole lecture. Those who act so unattractively, outrageously, provocatively by struggling for weird things like subsidized bread prices, land reform, public jobs, and rent control. The gentlemen historians don't ever bother to say, let's see what agitated these people. Did anything relate to their human needs, their sense of justice? Was it really all just a manifestation of irrational, low-life agitation? Wasn't there something about this Constitution and its liberties that were horribly limited and hypocritical? Instead, the common people are looked down upon. Cicero repeatedly described the urban poor as the, quote, city dirt and filth, the urban scum, unruly and inferior, a starving, contemptible rabble. Now note, he admits they're starving, but he sees that as their fault, their deficiency. And whenever the people agitated against class injustice, then they became something even worse in Cicero's mind, something even more dangerous, more loathsome. They became the mob. Appian, Appian, writing a century after Cicero, describes Caesar as, quote, introducing laws to win the favor of the mob, whom he describes as the poor and hot-headed. In our own day, P.A. Brunt refers to the city mob. For Lily Ross Taylor, it's the city rabble. For Cyril Robinson, it's the stupid Roman mob, a selfish, good-for-nothing, parasitic mob. Don't hold back, Cyril. For Scullard, it's the idle urban mob, as if their idleness were of their own choice. And if they were so idle, who did all the work? It wasn't all slave labor. In fact, in the urban areas, it was mostly not slave labor. Meanwhile, the aristocratic idlers, the real parasites, who live in obscene opulence, they earn not a harsh word from the great majority of these writers. Another classic historian, a modern day, John Dickinson, charges that Caesar appealed to the cupidity of those who desired to be supported by the state. Dickinson repeatedly writes of Clodius and his mob. Clodius, by the way, was a populares ally of Caesar, who sought to legalize the political ward clubs. He was an aristocrat, one of the populares. He organized neighborhoods and guilds to political action. He armed neighborhood cadres to defend themselves against the ruling class toughs. He outlawed executions without trial, a direct jab at Cicero for the executions without trial that he perpetrated during the Catiline conspiracy. Clodius also extended the grain dole. All of this is judged by Professor Dickinson as attempts to, quote, tighten the control of the mob over political life. Other historians describe Clodius as a demagogue and an adventurer. He and a large number of his followers were murdered by a ruling class death squad operative named Milo and his band of paid gladiators. Later brought to trial, Milo was defended by Cicero. Incidentally, Milo's thugs are never described as a mob, even though they acted like mobsters. So outraged by Clodius's murder, the Roman plebs, the proletariat called the plebs, they brought his body into the Senate house, put it down, put a pile of chairs, and started a funeral pyre and burned down the Senate house. During the early empire, the Roman poet Juvenal wrote scornfully of the mob's preoccupation with bread and circuses, a phrase that has echoed down to us over the centuries, adding to the image of Rome's proletariat as a shiftless, volatile mass addicted to endless handouts of free food and free entertainment. Elite historians have ever been alert to the corrupting influence that state assistance supposedly inflicts on the poor. Appian tells us that the corn ration attracted the idly destitute and hot-headed elements of the Italian population to the capital, whom he contrasts with those, quote, those who possessed property and good sense. Almost 1900 years later, Scullard writes that Clodius's law to change the corn subsidy into a completely free dole, quote, hastened the demoralization of the people. When the reactionary Sulla, 40 years before, abolished the corn distribution, this was called reform by our gentlemen historians, and no critical comment on the immense hardship it might have inflicted on the urban poor. This image of an idle mob of layabouts sponging off the state is little more than a figment of upper-class and middle-class imagination, both ancient and modern alike. It's interesting that so many of those who've written about Rome find it so disreputable that the humble Romans should have been concerned about having enough food for themselves and their children. Oh, they wanted bread. Imagine that. This hardly makes them materialistic or degraded. By the way, in any event, only a very limited number in Rome received the regular corn dole. And furthermore, man cannot live by bread alone, even at the physiological and material level. The proletarians need money for food, clothing, cooking fuel, other necessities. Most of them had to find work, low-paying and irregular as it might be. The bread dole often was a necessary supplement. It often was the difference between survival and starvation. but it was not a source of total support that allowed them to idle away their days. This raises another question. Who exactly was the mob? The same question comes up in regard to the French Revolution. You read Stanley Loomis's book on the French Revolution, 400 pages. I started becoming aware of it through it. I began to realize 400 pages, he never once talks about the people, the citizenry, the popular crowds. It was always the Parisian mob, the Parisian rabble, the mob, the mob, the mob. Well, who made up the mob? The answer given for both Rome of 44 BC and Paris of 1798 AD is the same. Or 1789 AD is the same. They were lumpens, drifters, riffraff. In fact, closer study reveals that in both Rome and Paris, the so-called mob consisted of artisans, craftsmen, shopkeepers, day laborers, masons, teamsters, dock workers, respectable, hard-working proletarians. And the circuses. What about the circuses? Who went to the arena? Many writers seem to forget that the urban poor were not the ones who created and financed the awful spectacles of the amphitheater, nor were they the only ones to attend. Probably a higher percentage of nobles and equestrians attended, seating in that lowest first tier where they can get the best view of the slaughter of humans and animals. The common people of ancient Rome, like the common people of so many societies, had scant opportunity to leave a written record of their grievances and aspirations. What little we know of them suggests that the proletariat could sometimes display a social consciousness superior to anything possessed by their would-be superiors. Many of them worked next to slaves and were themselves freedmen or sons of freedmen, being almost as poor as slaves. In 63, during Cicero's witch hunt, several dissenting leaders urged workmen and slaves to take action against the oligarchs. Such appeals wouldn't have made sense unless there was some kind of community interest between plebs and slaves. In parts of Sicily, the agrarian proletariat joined in common cause with slaves to rebel against big planters on several occasions, including Spartacus's great rebellion. Not all of Spartacus's men were slaves. A lot of them were freedmen, poor, but they were so desperately poor, they sided with the slaves in common interest. And so, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, we face this largely one-sided recording of what is called history. Cicero, Brutus, and Cato come down to us as the defenders of liberty, when they were something quite contrary. And Caesar, who did something for the poor and moved against privileged property, who did something for economic democracy, comes down to us as an elitist tyrant. What we have here is the confusion of procedural democracy and substantive democracy. Remember, democracy must be something more than its procedure and its forms. It must also have a democratic output. Otherwise, it's very little more than just a legitimating cloak for class tyranny. And that was the heart of the matter with the Roman Republic and the danger with every capitalist republic of today. And those who fought for economic democracy because they faced a rigged system often might violate republican procedure and are immediately labeled as tyrants and power-hungry people. This was true of Caesar, Robespierre, Lenin, Huey Long, Fidel Castro, the Sandinistas. We heard it again and again. When were those Sandinistas going to have freedom in Nicaragua or Castroites in Cuba or wherever? No such question was raised when these countries were ruled by right-wing dictatorships that opened themselves to global investments and profit accumulation. The tyranny of the Sandinistas was that they were actually making changes in the economic system and class structure of Nicaragua. So, we must read against the grain when we read mainstream history, and we must swim against the mainstream, and we must try to keep connected to those who came before us. Certainly not the Ciceros and the Catos, as we're urged and trained to do, nor even the Gracchi or Caesar or the Populares leaders, but rather we must try to stay linked to the anonymous masses upon whose shoulders they stood, the common people, who struggled against all odds with all the courage and fear and all the inconsistencies of ordinary people, who put themselves on the line, whose names we will never know, whose blood and tears we will never see, whose words and cries of pain we will never hear, and yet to whom we are linked in a past that is never dead and never really past, and a future that never arrives but keeps beckoning us and keeps us going. So history never ends, the last page is never written, and the best pages are written not by princes and presidents and prime ministers and popes, and not even by professors, but by the people. For all their faults and shortcomings, the people are all we have. In fact, we are they. Thank you very much.
That was Dr. Michael Parenti speaking on A Republic Against Caesar, Class Power and Conspiracy in Ancient Rome with Lessons for Today. It was recorded in Berkeley, California in 1998. If you'd like to learn more about Dr. Parenti's work, you can visit his website at www.michaelparenti.org.
People say it doesn't exist. No one would like to admit that there is a city underground. People live every day off the waste and decay, off the disguise of their fellow man. Here in Sub City, life is hard. We can't receive any government relief. Won't you please, please give the president my honest regards for this regarding me. There's too much crime in these streets. My sentiments exactly. Government and big business hold the purse strings. When I worked in the factories. I'm at the mercy of the world. Guess I'm lucky to be alive. 'Cause here in Sub City, life is hard. We can't receive any government. Mr. President, my honest regards for this regarding me.
The Kensington Welfare Rights Union, the KWRU, is a group of poor Philadelphians who help each other survive while at the same time educate themselves and the wider society about the systemic causes and social stereotypes of poverty. Now, they're reaching out to the organized poor worldwide and have called for a Poor People's World Summit to take place in New York City, November 15th through 18th. The aims of the summit are expressed in their call for registrants as follows. Given the United States' domination of the economic, political, and military systems of countries around the world, we, the organized poor in the United States, believe that a movement of the poor in the U.S. has a strategic role to play in a global movement of the poor to end poverty worldwide. The dismantling of the welfare system in the U.S. and the rising level of structural unemployment as a result of globalization and downsizing have made possible for the first time in decades the multiracial unity of the poor in the U.S., and the unity of the poor in the U.S. with the poor in the rest of the world. The movement of the poor in the U.S. is in its very beginning stages and is incredibly undeveloped. We need to learn models of survival and organizing from brothers and sisters who have a long history of organizing large numbers of people who have nothing. For this reason, we are calling on the organized poor of the world to contribute to the building of a movement of the poor in the United States by participating in the Poor People's World Summit to End Poverty and sharing the lessons and histories of your movements. Galen Tyler of the KWRU spoke to activists from Catholic Charities and other community groups who gathered last month at Cornell.
Quite a few of us, about 30 of us from Ithaca, went down to Philadelphia for the Republican Convention, and Kensington Welfare Rights Union did an incredible march that was unpermitted. I'm going to guess about 15, 20,000 people. Some of the people in this room were at that march as well. Very disciplined march, and bringing to the nation's attention what we thought was the Republican Party's not paying attention to people's needs, and actually the Democrat Party's as well. It's my pleasure to introduce. What we're going to do is just have little introductions from both Galen Tyler and Ann Kretzman with the KWRU. Just little brief introductions about who you are, how you came to KWRU, and then just more of an explanation about what KWRU is. If we could start with you, Galen.
Good afternoon. How you doing? Like you said, my name is Galen Tyler. I've been with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union since 1997. When I became homeless and a family member told me about some of the work of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. I'm currently co-chair of the organizing committee of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, and I stay at one of the human rights houses with my wife and four kids, where on a daily basis we try to help people meet their basic necessities, also give them a voice, try to let them know that they have a voice in this political arena, that each person counts, you know, and about bringing about a change. And with that, we try to make sure that we help prevent people from becoming homeless and help those who have become homeless. So that's like some of the work that I've been doing since I've been with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union. And I could say a little bit more about the KWRU and some of the recent and past campaigns that I've been a part of and one of the recent ones coming up.
My name is Ann Kretzman, and I've been with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union for about a year and a half, and I'm doing student organizing for them.
So just to, you know, to go into real quick who the Kensington Welfare Rights Union is and, like, what the organization is about. The Kensington Welfare Rights Union is led by the poor. It's a very multiracial organization that have people that are currently or formerly homeless at the leadership of the organization. Kensington Welfare Rights Union was started back in like 1991 when a group of welfare recipient mothers who decided that it was easier for them to meet their basic necessities through working together. Just for example, if you got your check on the 1st and I didn't get mine to the 8th, you know what I mean, you would help me out with food and stuff like that and maybe pay a utility bill or something so that my utilities wouldn't get cut off. And in turn, when the 6th or the 7th came around, when I received my benefits, I would turn and help you by paying you back so you could in turn keep maintaining. With that, the Kensington Welfare Rights Union goes out. We work in the community with predominantly just poor people, but we also work with other different sections of the population too. Our main focus is trying to build leadership from the ranks of the poor so we can build this mass movement to end poverty. We know that poverty is a big issue that's not talked about, you know what I mean, in this country. So we see that it's going to take a big movement to bring this to light and also to resolve this problem. And so some of the things that I myself personally have been a part of with the Kensington Welfare Rights Union has been numbers of tent cities and housing takeovers, protests for affordable housing to right for medical care, to different downsizing at different unions. I also have been part of the New Freedom Bus tour that happened in 1998, where we took a bus all around the country. We was documenting economic human rights violations, not just in the inner city, but in rural areas and different towns, to show the difference. Poverty is the same whether you live, like if people are starving in the rural area, it's the same as people starving in the city. If people are going without utilities and food and clothing and stuff like that out in this in the rural area, it's the same as the people going without it in the inner city. So what we did, we did a bus tour where we visit over 34 different cities and towns where we did documentation and also met with other poor people's organizations around the country where we in turn developed this national campaign called the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, where it's made up of about, right now, currently, close to like 45 different poor people's organizations, ranging from Jesus People Against Pollution in Mississippi to the Coalition to Save Public Housing in Chicago, to Power out in California, to Deaf People on Human Rights in Lorain, Ohio, to a number of other different organizations that we work with around the country. And out of that campaign, we had this Poor People Summit in Philadelphia, where we made a call throughout the different campaigns where we was going to have this March of the Americas, where we was going to march from Washington, D.C. to the United Nations. Also, where we're going to document economic human violations, but not just here in the United States, but throughout the whole Western Hemisphere, where we was going to be able to sit back and have different discussions and dialogues with other poor people's organizations in Canada, as well as throughout Latin America and around the United States. And so with that, that was like a very like eye-opening to see, to meet people from Brazil who's part of the MST, which is like the largest landless peasant movement in the world, and hear some of their organizing strategies and their tactics and stuff like that to try to bring about a change was a great experience. Other different organizations from Peru, Guatemala, Mexico. We have people from Canada also, from Montreal, on this March of the Americas. And the first week of October in 1999, you know, when we started the March of the Americas, we introduced this petition or brief into the Office of American States, where we was indicting the United States on economic human rights violations, not just here in the United States, but all abroad too, where we're seeing that the United States has its hands in causing economic human rights violations throughout the world. With that, I seen a lot of different people develop, far as myself and other people also who was on the March of the America, who actually looked and seen like their personal situation, like myself, me and my family. We became homeless back in 1997 when I had a transportation issue where I got arrested for driving with an invalid driver's license, where I in turn lost my job and wasn't able to keep up my mortgage after I lost my job. That's when I became homeless and my family. I thought that was just like an individual situation where some of the decisions and stuff like that I made upon just not only just the education was through the Kinsler Welfare Rights Union, but through like meeting these different peoples and the bus tour that we did in 1998 and meeting different poor peoples from throughout the whole entire Western Hemisphere. All this right here opened up my eyes to see that this problem just doesn't stem from an individual. Through, you know, just like meeting, like I was saying, like meeting the people on the March of the Americas from the different poor people's organizations throughout Latin America and Canada, I was able to see that it's something more, it's something stemming more from just people's individual situations on how they conduct their daily lives, far as people's making decisions and thinking like the decision that they made is what landed them in the situation that they're in right now. Like I said, meeting people from the MST and other parts of the world, it was an eye-opener to see like some of their strategies and tactics, and like to see how some of the poverty issues that they was going through and Latin America and Canada and stuff like that are some of the same poverty issues that we was going through right here in North Philadelphia that I was going through myself. And I seen the connection, just as the world trade ministers and the people at the IMF and World Bank and stuff like that cross borders, that keep their policies and tech. I think we have to cross borders ourselves to bring about a change to these policies. Just here recently, the July 31st March for Economic Human Rights that brought people from all around the country to Philadelphia. It was like 15,000 reporters in the city during the Republican National Convention. Our march was permitted, where we had a tent city where we stayed up an encampment for like 5 days. It was called Bushville, where we kind of named it after the nominee, the Republican nominee. And we had people come all over, from environmentalists to women's issues, to welfare rights organizations, to housing organizations, from all different walks of this movements that are happening around the country. And we sat down and we had like little schoolings and the different workshops and the teachings, and where we was able to have like real discussion and see that how all these different movements, how they have like a root cause, and how we should link these groups up. and try to bring about a change here in the United States. I'm going to let Anne talk a little bit. You know what I mean? This is maybe she wants something to think, like if she wants to say some stuff.
I guess I'll just talk about, maybe I'll talk about the World Summit. We're having this World Summit to End Poverty, and it's November 15th through 18th. It's going to be in New York City. And the goal of this is to bring homeless organizations and delegates from, not necessarily homeless, but different poor people's organizations from around the country, from each country and each state in our country. And it's to bring people together and to talk about like what their experiences have been, what strategies they've used, how they've been able to resist the problems that they're facing every day, and then more importantly, how to build up a communication system between the different groups and to begin to talk about like what a movement to end poverty is really going to look like, because we know that in this country, we can't fight it by ourselves. It needs to be one that's fought, you know, a global movement of the poor. And that's what it's called, like Poor People's World Summit to End Poverty, a global movement of the poor. Up here, we have the registration packets and call for it.
To go back to like the things that the Kings of the Welfare Rights Union do on a daily basis, we see that massive amount of people come into our office every day with different problems around having problems with a caseworker or having problems with getting a medical card or having a problem with food or having problems with, you know, housing issues, you know, utilities. What we do is we try to help them meet people exactly where they are and where they're at. And from there, do this long process. We have like process where we go where people can become members of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union through attending 4 membership meetings and talking about the different issues that affect people right there locally, and try to get people to organize around that exactly where they are. And then in turn, give them a broader educational where people are able to see the big picture, how the World Trade Organization and the IMF and the World Bank, some of their policies just affect people right here in the United States. It's not something that you can do overnight when people have been beaten down, told that they don't matter, they don't count, they're lazy, they're shiftless, they don't want to work, you know, all these different types of things, stereotypes have been put out there and the media and people having perception of what a welfare recipient looks like, what a homeless man looks like, all these different types of perceptions that's been out there. And what we're saying is that the average person of a, you know, the average age of a welfare, I mean, the average age of a homeless person is like 8 years old, a child. So it's not like what you see on TV when you go downtown or something like that, a homeless man with maybe some mental issues or something like that, or a Vietnam vet or something like that, that they want to try to make it, or someone's on drugs or alcoholic or something like that. That's not the average or the image of a homeless person. And so what we do, we try to beat down all these stereotypes that have been put out there and show that the poor can organize and do things like take a bus around the country, you know, and document economic human rights violation, to show them that the poor can lead a march from Washington, D.C. all the way to New York without any type of permit whatsoever. Poor people can lead a march down Broad Street right in the middle during the Republican National Convention, where you had all the oppositions of the whole, like all the city administrative constantly keep saying, no, this wasn't going to happen. And, you know, we do these things to show that people's economic situation doesn't determine who a person is. And that's because I myself, you know what I mean, I don't have $1.95, but I do see that I have something to give to bring about a change. Because I know the United States, it's made up of nothing but wonderful people. But we do have people here that are greedy. We do have people here that don't have no type of respect for the human element or the human life. Some of these people that don't have respect or are very well off. What we're trying to say, that because you have money doesn't make a person a good person. And we're saying that the way that we can bring about a change in this country is through the hearts and minds of the masses of the people in these United States. Like 1% of the population controls upwards to like 48% of the wealth in this country. It's this economic boom that everybody wants to talk about. Everybody wants to talk about the economic boom, but nobody wants to talk about the other side of the coin, which is this economic doom that masses of the people are seeing. In Philadelphia, the issue of homelessness could be resolved like that, like the snap of a finger, if the people and the administration and the politician was their actual intention. you know, it could be ended. In Philadelphia, they said it's like 27,000 abandoned houses in Philadelphia, but it's like 23,000 abandoned people registered as homeless. So, you know, right then, every man, woman, child in the shelter system that's registered as being homeless can all get a house and still be like 4,000 left. You know, I'm not no scholar or anything like that, but I can add, and I know like 27,000 houses and 23,000 homeless people, that doesn't equal 23,000 homeless people. You know what I mean? In my book. But in other people's books, you know, that's what it adds up to be, because it's more about dollar than the human element itself. And that's what we're trying to get people to see. Like, the mass of the people, like I said, the mass of the people in this country are good people. And that when we're able to win the hearts and minds of people, saying that no more are we going to stand by and let one man freeze to death in Chicago. No more are we going to stand by for women and children to starve to death, you know, throughout the United States and abroad. And just one recent incident that happened in like 1998 that kind of like stays like hard in my heart right now, because this woman from Dominican Republic, who husband got deported, and she went to apply for welfare. And when she went to apply for welfare, they used her husband's income status 2 months ago. So like they was looking at what he made 2 months ago, not what they had today. And he's gone out of the country. They was looking at 2 months ago. So she was denied welfare. She got it in English. She couldn't speak English or anything. She only spoke Spanish. So like a week and a half later, she did a homicide suicide where she killed her 3 kids and killed herself. She couldn't just keep sitting back looking at her kids go hungry without any way of being able to feed and clothe her kid. And we're seeing that with, like in Philadelphia, with 57,000 people about to be cut off of welfare for life, and jobs aren't being created, only these programs that talk about career placement, you know, and all these makeshift jobs, and people aren't going to have a way of supporting and feeding and clothing their family. You know, we're looking at, you know, some type of explosion. Our former mayor, Mayor Rendell, said that the Philadelphia is like a train wreck waiting to happen. He had this full page article out in the Philadelphia Weekly talking about how the way it's going, it's going to be a train wreck. And we're just sitting back watching it. Our director, Sherry Hunkler, she always says, if you see kids laying on a track, you know, and a train is coming, you got to feel obligated to do something about moving those kids off the track. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sure that we ensure that by building a broad movement throughout the masses of the people in this country and saying that no longer are we going to stand by for these economic human rights violations, and make sure that we're able to hold the government accountable. I mean, so that there are no more economic human rights violations. We know this country was set up on, you know, a creed that said that everybody had a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, if you have no way of feeding your family, or if you don't have a job that pays a livable wage, you don't have no education, you don't have health care, it's kind of hard to have life and liberty and try to pursue some happiness. And that's what we're saying, that we're trying to get the, you know, the masses of the people to see. It's not to try to throw heavy weights on anyone's shoulders, because each person should be able to do exactly what they can do to contribute to build this movement. And it's not to throw any type of extra heavy weight, but people got to see themselves in a relationship where, or am I want to, do I want to be in on the side where people are laying off hundreds and thousands of workers just to make a bigger profit? 250,000 jobs have left Philadelphia, you know what I mean, like the last 2 decades, and they was manufacturing jobs that people, you know, I don't know if people know, but Philadelphia used to, Kensington itself used to be the mecca of the textile industry, linking up to the Midwest with the Conrails. That's something that never talked about, Kensington. Kensington is talked about as being the Badlands, because when all these jobs, the factory jobs, went to South Carolina and then in turn going south of the border, it left this big vacuum that welfare and crime filled. Like I was saying, you know, earlier today, Kensington, the number one source of income in Kensington is welfare. The number two source of income in Kensington is drugs. So, you know, when you cut welfare off, no one's going to be able to get welfare anymore. And we're seeing the city's preparing themselves, because they're building more and more penitentiaries. They have increased the police force. They increased the police presence. And it's not about trying to, like, don't start, like let's create an environment and a condition where the riots won't happen. Let's create an environment and condition for that. No, they're creating the conditions where we know the riots going to happen, but we building all these jails and stuff like that. We're just going to lock them up compared to trying to change it and stop the riot. And that's what the Kensington Welfare Rights Union is doing. We see that we're trying to link people up to a movement to bring about a change, not to go out and when you don't have any food or anything, to go out and turn on someone else who's going through the same struggle, who's having a hard time feeding and clothing and housing their family. Don't go out and riot and try to burn down the local store right there, the corner store, who's having a hard time himself, struggling and surviving the way the system is set up right now. We've been doing voter registration prior to the 10th. We was doing for the last couple of months, we was doing voter registration, trying to get people to see that right now, each one teaching one, but like each individual, they do mean, like it do matter. Cause people tend to think on one side, people say, oh, every vote counts and stuff like that. But then you got you don't even really get the candidate that you want to vote for in the first place. So in that sense, it's kind of hard to say my vote counts. And on another side of it, each individual linking up with more and more individuals who see things the same way they do, that do count. I was telling a student, somebody earlier, that politicians, they listen to, two things. One is a lot of money. And two, a lot of people. And we don't have a lot of money. So what we're trying to do is have a lot of people to come out and make sure that we get a government that represents us.
I wanted to ask you, if you don't mind telling me something personal, how did you begin to get this analysis that would take you from thinking individually to looking at global ideas and global justice?
When I became homeless in 1997, like that was like a blow just to, it's sad, for me to say this, but it was a blow to my ego to not being able to provide for my wife and my kids. And that right there, had me at my lowest point. When I was staying with my family, who house that I was staying at had won it through the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, she was telling me how they helped fight for affordable housing. And so when she was by that, I went, started going to the membership meeting, helping with food distribution, and actually seeing other people go through the same thing that I was going through, and hear other people tell their story about the struggle that they went through, and then started hearing all these different things about that I was never taught in high school. Like to start hearing about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Articles 23, 25, and 26, my whole entire life, all the way up until I was 27, not once did I know that the majority of the countries in this world said just by being born on this planet, everybody should have these basic things, a right to a job, a right to food, clothing, housing, a right to education, a right to healthcare. I never heard any of that stuff until becoming homeless. So at the lowest point in my life, I heard some of the things that could bring about a change, not just for myself, but which would bring about a change that would create no condition. The condition wouldn't exist for my kids or my grandkids to become homeless, because I didn't really understand why there wasn't no jobs and stuff like that, but looking at those factories in North Philadelphia to see that they were the reason why a factory would close down and shut down and leave tens of thousands of people out of work. I didn't know why that would happen, but to see that some small percentage of CEOs and corporations that would make a large profit, they take their factory down to South Carolina, somewhere where they would pay workers $6 an hour compared to paying the Philadelphia wage of $15-16 an hour or something like that. And then to even take it further to south of the border, where some of that stuff started giving me an understanding that this problem stems much more than from any one individual. And in order for us to need to bring about a change to this big problem, it's going to take a mass amount of people. And I have dedicated myself to being able to talk about my situation and some of the things I learned, and hope that it inspire other people to learn. I don't want anybody to take anything I say on face value. I want people to in turn to go out and study and look and investigate and see, is this America that we live in? Is it the America that we want to live in?
What scares me the most is the 5-year time limit. Do you see anything happening to turn the Congress around on that to back off of that 5-year time limit? Is there anything that we can do to stop that? Because that's coming up.
The main thing that I can say that we could do is like constantly keep talking about this issue, constantly keep putting this out in the forefront. I don't want to seem like I'm against abortion or I'm for abortion because, you know what I mean, I don't even really know if I am or I ain't. But I do know that that's a big issue that everybody want to spend money and time and stuff like that talking about. And some women don't even live to the point where they can even have kids. Some women get preventable diseases because of, you know what I mean, the economic situation that stopped them from being able to have kids. So I think we should go to the root cause of a lot of the issues and just constantly keep putting it out there. Whenever your welfare reform date, like the time limit, whatever it is, like keep each year, let's keep doing stuff on those dates and making sure that people know that it's this train wreck that's about to happen. It's going to take a lot of people to make sure that it doesn't happen.
The question I would have at this point is, do you see any difference between the two major parties in terms of their sensitivity to these issues?
I watched the TV. I watched the debates. I hope other people watched the debates. I didn't see anything to distinguish between the two. It's a couple little touchy issues that they're talking about are different. But we're seeing that the Democratic Party is what, you know, that signed in welfare reform. We haven't seen any from my personal experience, just here looking at politics from all the way back in the past, the Democrats and Republicans. And it's always seemed to me that neither the right wins or neither the left wins. It's always been the moderate Republicans that win and the moderate Democrats that win. And they're pretty much going straight down the middle, side by side.
The thing that bothers me the most is the fact that we don't label corporate welfare in the same breath as we're talking about welfare for you.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of money going into corporate welfare so far exceeds whatever went into personal welfare, that it's just absolutely irrational.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to encourage you and everybody else to remember, whenever welfare comes up, we talk about corporate welfare, not just say that the corporations are preventing us from earning a living by paying us a low wage, but they're making most of their profits from tax breaks and government subsidies. The railroads never would have been built without government subsidies across this nation. There's all sorts of examples of where corporations would not survive without mass government infusion. Lockheed would have gone under. But I really think it's important to remember and be aware of how much government money goes into corporations.
That's more of the stereotypes that I was just speaking about earlier that's out there about this myth about my taxpayer dollars going to this welfare recipient that could sit back and keep having more babies and drive a Cadillac in the projects. It's not about trying to move people away from the way they're living. It's about moving other people so that they can live. It's not that we want to take like money and the golf course, like the golf games and stuff like that away from people. We're saying we're trying to move it where everybody can have some rest and relaxation and stuff like that. You know, that shouldn't be a crime that because you can play golf and afford to swim in a swimming pool in your backyard. That shouldn't be a crime. The crime should be allowing 46 million people in this country to go without health care. That's the crime.
Like, the other thing you have to think about is that there's more than enough to go around. Like, it's not that they need to change their lives drastically, but it's rather that, you know, there needs to be a redistribution of power, and, you know, and just for them to understand that.
It takes like 4 billion pounds to feed the whole entire country, but yet we throw away 46 billion every year. That's the type of stuff that we're seeing, like the people who have control over these resources, how that can get to the masses of the people.
I'm interested in learning more about welfare rights unions in general. I've looked through your website, which is very informative. I think that's a great way of getting information out. And I'm trying to imagine what first steps would be if we wanted to begin to make welfare rights union come to blossom here in upstate rural New York.
Y'all on the right track because y'all here, y'all having this, you know, this dialogue with me and like other people that, you know, you should look at other poor people's organization around the country. And also just, you know, just keep having these little forums, these little meetings, these little community grouping, because we're in the process of Kinsley Welfare Action. We're in this retrenchment process where we're going to where people are and trying to start little organizing committees, you know, right there on the block, whether it's three houses, four houses, but figure out how organizing that one block could make it better for the whole, organize three or four families where they do, whether food distribution or they collect canned goods or whether they collect like old clothing and stuff like that people don't need, whether they get Pampers, whatever that they can do to like bring like some little relief so people can in turn sit down and have discussions around like what the real root cause of the problem that they're going through, like why they have to figure out how they're going to organize to get some food. That's what, if people try to meet people where they are and help them where they're at, and then in turn use that as an opportunity to discuss on a larger scale.
What I think is really neat about the Kinsley's Welfare Team is that it's so, you know, by poor people and people of color, and most of the people that are activists in this area are white academics. And I think it's, you know, really hard for me to know how to start something that will really attract people that, and no offense if I'm wrong, but I don't think anyone in this room is particularly in need of welfare reform. But I mean, I don't know exactly how to, you know, get to those people and get them interested.
We have that same struggle too. You know, that's like the same struggle all over. And you know what we try to do? We try to be creative. It would be hard for me to give you like a set thing to do right here in Ithaca, because each area, each place, it's kind of unique in like the type of atmosphere, the people and the environment. And who would know it more in that the go-to and ask these questions to is the people who actually live right there. That's what I was saying about the retrenchment process, is that the people in the community and the neighborhood, they know who's who. You know, in our office, we get people who come in all the time with different scams and stuff like that to try to help. But we're doing the process where we're going to go into the neighborhood so people would know, like, you know what I mean? I know he's scam. He's about to go buy some crack rock or something, you know what I mean? Or use that to go sell it to do something else, compared to, you know what I mean, actually using the clothes for the kids or actually using the food and stuff like that. And by going in the community, the community knows the other people, you know what I mean? And that's the way you can do the be creative, like ask them. That's what we did. We went straight to the community and asked the people, and that started the process. In 1991, when those six welfare recipients came together to form the Kensington Welfare Rights Union, they did door knocking in Kensington to figure out what were some of the upfront issues that people were in need of right then and now. One of the major issue that everybody talked about in Kensington was a job. And, you know, back then those six welfare recipients couldn't give people jobs. But the second thing was about the children, that they wanted a place where their kids could play away from, you know, the drug activity, away from the crime, away from the prostitution, all that stuff. They wanted a place for their kids to be safe. And that's how the Kids of Welfare Rights Union did its first major action, which was trying to take over a community center for the youths in that community.
That was Galen Tyler of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union speaking in Ithaca last month. If you'd like more information about attending the Poor People's World Summit, you can go to the KWRU website at www.kwru.org or call their office at area code 215-203-1945. That's 215-203-1945. Also, for listeners of WEOS, tune into the Nobody Show this coming Thursday at 7:30 in the evening, when guests from the KWRU will discuss the upcoming summit. The music in today's program was Sub City by Tracy Chapman.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. You can also download shows you may have missed or get more info on the topics covered. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle.